Earlier, you heard the ancient Taoist story of the master carver who carved a wooden bell stand for a prince that was so beautiful that all who saw it thought it must be the work of supernatural spirits instead of mere human hands. But the master carver shared that his art was not of supernatural origin, but rather the result of practicing the ancient Taoist art of Wu Wei, of non-action, of effortlessness, non-intervention, and non-interference. From a meditative state of calm and centered equanimity, meaning mental calmness and composure and evenness of temper, even in the midst of a difficult circumstance, so you can hear that word equal, balance, for equanimity, that master carver waited patiently for the right tree, the right timing, and the right movement to arise. And this ancient tale of doing one thing extraordinarily well at the right time and the right place, and doing it with focus, with grace, and with a deep connection to nature, is a potential source of wisdom for us today in our crazy busy age of technological distraction. Taoism reminds us that there are other ways of being in the world that can bring balance and order out of the chaos that is sometimes around us. As the bumper sticker wisdom goes, Taoism says to us, don't just do something, sit there. Just doing something, anything, just to do something, is the opposite of Wu Wei, of non-action, which invites us to a practice of effortlessness, non-action, non-interference, non-intervention. Taoism invites us to consider if the most radical act we can sometimes do is paradoxically to hold ourselves back, to sit there and do nothing. As you were asked to reflect upon in the spoken meditation, is there a time in your life when you took the risk of stepping back and of trusting others, and because you didn't try to micromanage the process and force others to go the way that you thought was the only possible way to do things, did it result in an outcome that was perhaps surprisingly beautiful in a way that you never could have anticipated and perhaps would have blocked from happening if you had insisted on forcing things in the direction you thought they had to go? If specific stories have come to your mind, I'd be interested to hear from them later if you're willing to share. Personally, I experience this phenomenon all the time here as your minister. First of all, it would be far beyond my capacity to even try to micromanage and control the 10,000 things that are going on here, in, within, and beyond, and through this congregation. Social justice work, art shows, spirituality groups, music, discussion groups, and so much more. There's a sense in which my role here as minister is to be a centering presence amidst all that activity. But if I was trying to micromanage those 10,000 things, not only would it be impossible, but it would undermine the possibilities of our collective flourishing. Along these lines, I've read many books by the contemporary Buddhist teacher and writer Thich Nhat Hanh, but probably the most challenging of his books to me is called Nothing to Do, Nowhere to Go. Because that is not how I feel. I don't feel like I have nothing to do and nowhere to go. Has anybody read that book by Thich Nhat Hanh? It's one of his least read books, actually, which is unfortunate. But so Nothing to Do, Nowhere to Go, Waking Up to Who You Are. Reflecting on the teachings of a 9th century Buddhist master named Lin Ji, Hanh invites us to consider that what might actually be inhibiting spiritual growth for many of us is that we're always just doing something, even sometimes spiritual things. And even if that something that we're just doing is seeking a spiritual teacher, visiting retreat centers, reading another spiritual book, Hanh writes, if you do all those things, even all those spiritual things, you will not be equal to the person who has nothing to do when he or she enters the temple and sits down in the lotus position and just sits. Ironically, our spiritual activities, even our spiritual activities, can themselves be a distraction from really being fully present to ourselves, to our breath, to the world around us. So, nothing to do, nowhere to go, colon, waking up to who you really are, right? So it's only by finally just sitting with nothing to do and nowhere to go that you have the chance to wake up to who you really are. Otherwise, you're just doing something and distracting yourself from really being present. So there's a sense in which, no matter where you are, learning to just sit may be the most transformative spiritual practice of all. Han writes that Zen Master Linji's term for such a person is a businessless person. Businessless. What a radical aspiration in our time of radical mass overcommitment. When so many books and articles and seminars are being offered on time management, to be able to say, I don't need your course on time management. I'm a businessless person. I'm just sitting here, nothing to do, nowhere to go. And I'm okay with that. And since I've been using some analogies from Zen Buddhism, I should say that there really are some important similarities between Buddhism and Taoism. They arise in ancient China from a similar philosophic context and worldview. But there's also some important differences between Buddhism and Taoism. And I'm not going to get into all those today, but instead allow me to kind of shift now to a more direct focus on the Tao Te Ching, which is the most significant text from the Taoist tradition. Regarding the spelling of that book, if you look in your order of service at the sermon title, you'll see Tao Te Ching spelled with a T, and then, which you may be more accustomed to, you also see it spelled with a D, which is what you're increasingly seeing. And you may recall I preached a sermon back in January, I think, on what used to be known as the I Ching, right, spelled capital I, C-H-I-N-G, which you would think pronounce. Do you ever pronounce that I Ching, not knowing what? Okay, I did too. So yeah, it's actually I Ching, and that's super confusing. Just like saying, here's this book, the Tao Te Ching. You're like, well, why is it spelled Tao, you know, why is it spelled with a T? Well, the reason has to do with British colonialism. I'm not going to go too much into that, but we used to have this system called the Wade-Giles system of transliteration that a bunch of British colonialists went to China and said, here's how we should transliterate Chinese characters into English, and it's called the Wade-Giles system. Now we have a new system called Pinyin, and it's Chinese people saying, actually, this is how you should translate Chinese into English. And so as a result of that, it's a little confusing. It's been very distressing to marketers, as they say. So now you'll often see both of them because they want to publish the Tao Te Ching, and they want to use the new system, but that they're anxious that people won't recognize it. So anyway, that's what's going on. The preferred spelling of the I Ching is now Y-I-J-I-N-G. The preferred spelling of the Tao Te Ching is now D-A-O-D-E-J-I-N-G. The preferred spelling of Lao Tzu, L-A-O-T-Z-U, is now Lao Tzu, L-A-O-Z-I. So anyway, that's the traditional author of the Tao Te Ching. He didn't really write it. We'll get to that in a second. So anyway, that's what's going on when you see the Tao Te Ching and what's going on in our 21st century globalized world. And if you're curious to learn more about the Tao Te Ching, the best accessible Taoism scholar, so if you know, there's some really great, I think, popular translations like Stephen Mitchell's Tao Te Ching and stuff like that, but those are done by amateurs. So if you want to find something that somebody who knows the best scholarship and is trying to write something accessible, the best scholar I've found, his name is Hans-Georg Moeller. He's German and now teaches in Canada. So it's M-O-E-L-L-E-R. And he has a translation and commentary on the Tao Te Ching, as well as a book called The Philosophy of the Tao Te Ching, which was came out in 2006 from Columbia University Press, and is pretty accessible. So those are good starting points if you're interested in reading more. And according to Moeller and these other contemporary scholars of Taoism, the text we know as the Tao Te Ching was not written by Lao Tzu or any other one ancient historical figure. Instead, it is an anthology of wise sayings that were transmitted among the intellectual of elite in China about 2,500 years ago. And then starting around 300 BCE, so about maybe a century, century and a half after Socrates, about 300 years before the historical Jesus, that's when those oral traditions that were circulating began to be written down and began to take the sort of final edited form that we know today as the Tao Te Ching. At first, this analogy was actually not called the Tao Te Ching. It was called the Lao Tzu, after the person formerly known as Lao Tzu, who people speculate did he even exist. Later, during China's Han Dynasty, is when it became written down, and was given that traditional title, Tao Te Ching, as an honorific, and it means the classical scripture of the way and its efficiency. So if you think about the three syllables, Tao, Te, Ching, the better way to think of it is the Jing about the Tao and the Te. So Jing means classical scripture, is the classical scripture about the Tao, about this way of being in the world, and about Te, the most powerful and efficient way of living that way of being in the world. So the classical scripture of the way and its efficacy is one way it's sometimes translated. Originally, the wisdom sayings that became the Tao Te Ching were memorized and through recitation by a Chinese social elite who would have been trained to know them by heart. And for that reason, it can be a little odd for those of us who are encountering them for the first time in written form. So you can say, this seems a little repetitive to me, or this seems to be in no discernible order. Well, that's because originally you were supposed to have them all memorized, and those repetitive parts actually helped you memorize them. So that's one problem that sometimes people have when they're reading it, as opposed to how the original adherents encountered it. It's important to emphasize as well that not only was the Tao Te Ching in ancient China known mostly to China's social elite who had the leisure time to sit around and memorize ancient wisdom sayings, but also the Tao Te Ching's original intent is actually explicitly elitist. It was meant not to be studied by everyone. It was composed in the strict sense only for one type of person, the Taoist sage ruler who wanted to rule as a sage according to Taoist wisdom. Consider, for example, this stanza from chapter 20 of the Tao. What simplicity! The ordinary people are shining. I alone, the ruler, seem to be hidden. The ordinary people are distinct. I alone am undifferentiated. My desires alone are different from those of the other people. I esteem the nurturing mother. So that's the sort of a ruler they're seeking to be, like a nurturing mother. Now, that's not exactly a rousing endorsement of our UU fifth principle of democracy, right? But it's a good reminder that the way of being in the world outlined by the Tao Te Ching was not originally intended to be universally practiced at all times and places by all parts of society. It's a guide for leaders. So, you know, sometimes I'll have people come to me and say, I've actually had this happen, that I'm not any of you, but that I've had people come to me and say, I'm really resonating with the Tao Te Ching. I'm trying to practice it in my life, and I'm feeling like nothing's happening and it's not working. What I want to sarcastically say, and don't, is, oh, did you inherit an ancient Chinese kingdom to rule over? Because if so, Taoism's going to work out great for you. But if not, then you may have to adapt it, because it's not meant to be employed strictly always for all situations in an ordinary person's life. That's, I think, maybe the most common misperception about the Tao Te Ching. But regardless of the Tao's original elitism, it does still potentially have wisdom for us today, and part of that's because it really is so different from the way many of us live our lives. Keep in mind that the best leader from a Taoist perspective is someone who embodies that ideal we heard earlier from Thich Nhat Hanh of a businessless person. So being ruled by a businessless person, someone who, like the woodcarver, operates from a place of centeredness, of calm, of equanimity, someone who is a living embodiment of Wu Wei, of non-action, of effortlessness, of non-intervention and non-interference. According to the Tao, the paradoxical promise of such a leader is that the emptiness at the center will allow room for the rest of us to grow into our full potential, because we're not being top-down forced into some sort of predetermined way of doing things. Chapter 57 of the Tao says it this way: I don't act, but the people change themselves. I love stillness, and the people correct themselves. I am without task, and the people prosper by themselves. To me, it sounds a little bit like libertarianism meets paradoxical mysticism, for better or worse. But again, I do think there is some wisdom for us, especially things like considering how the Tao might invite us and make us more likely than we might have been otherwise if we hadn't been studying Taoism recently, to refrain from micromanaging people and processes that might well prosper better if left to their own natural timing, rhythms, and inclinations, and that you might be creating suffering and conflict unnecessarily by trying to force other people and situations to go the way that you think they need to go. And although there's much more to say about the Tao Te Ching, I would like for now to make one final point about the ways that the Taoist perspective is deeply resonant with our seventh Yuyu principle of the interdependent web of all existence. The worldview of Taoism reminds us very strongly that all of us humans, whether sage rulers or just us ordinary common folk, are merely one part of the massive whole that is nature. That is the cosmos. We humans are not special in the grand scheme of things. So we should be cautious in overinterpreting what happens to us as good in the big G sense, as in ontologically good determined on high by some supernatural sense, or that something that bad that happened to us is really bad in some terrible ultimate sense. From a Taoist point of view, all that happens is part of a complex, intricate, larger whole, and we may or may not have the capacity from our finite human perspective to understand why things happen to us. As it says in chapter 58 of the Tao Te Ching, it is upon bad luck that good luck depends. It is upon good luck that bad luck depends. Who knows where it ends? You can think about that ongoing cycle of the yin-yang, the black and white circle kind of going in perpetual spiral and mixing together. But perhaps it's best exemplified in this ancient Taoist tale. There was an old man at a frontier fort in the north of China who understood Taoism. One day, he lost his horse, which wandered into the land of nearby tribesmen, with which they did not have a good relationship, so he could not easily go back and get his horse. His neighbors came down to console him, and the man said, "How do you know that this is bad luck, that I lost my horse?" After a few months, the horse returned with some fine horses from that neighboring tribe. It came back by itself and brought some horses with it. And the people congratulated him and said, and he said, though, "How do you know that it is good luck that I now have so many fine horses?" He became very prosperous with those horses. But then his son one day broke his leg riding one of those horses. And all the people came to console him. And the old man said again, "How do you know this is bad luck that my son broke his leg?" And one day, those neighboring tribesmen invaded that frontier fort in the north of China. All the young men who were healthy fought with arrows to defend it, and 9/10 of them were killed. But because this man's son had a broken leg, he was not able to fight. He and his father survived. Therefore, according to Taoism, good luck changes into bad luck, bad luck changes into good, and it cannot be known where the altering ends. And so we find ourselves returning to one of those central characteristics of the Taoist master: equanimity, mental calmness, composure, evenness of temper, even and especially in a difficult situation. Whatever happens to us is never just about us individually or even just about us collectively as a human species. We are part of a complex, intricate, larger whole, an interdependent web of all existence. So what wisdom might the Tao Te Ching hold for you today? Are there situations in your life that might best be served by choosing non-action, non-interference, non-intervention? What might it feel like to experiment occasionally with being a businessless person? Take it out for a test drive if you can carve out the time and the space to just sit there with nothing to do and nowhere to go. What transformation might that bring for you? Or might you, like the woodcarver, be well served by waiting patiently for the right time and place to act with effortless precision? Or does the story of the old man at the frontier fort invite you to consider if perhaps some of what is going on in your life, whether seemingly good or bad, is actually not about you, but just part of the intricate whole of which we are apart.